From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review The Lego Movie 2, the second part. We'll find out if the film directed by Mike Mitchell hit some of the comedic highs of the first Lego film. What Men Want, a romantic comedy starring Taraji P. Henson, Adam Shankman, the director, and High Flying Bird, directed by Steven Soderbergh, a Netflix movie. That, too, reviewed on Film Week.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances, for consideration in all categories.
And by Marvel Studios' Black Panther, now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Costume and Production Design, Score, Original Song, All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Just a reminder, we're just over a week away from the 17th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview at the Theater at Ace Hotel, Sunday afternoon, February 17th. Sure hope to see you there. Tickets available, kpcc.org/in-person. The three critics joining me today will all be on stage along with their peers. With me today, film critic Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast, and Claudia Puig. She's the top one at the LA Film Critics Association, president of the group, which just gave out its prestigious critical awards. We begin with The Lego Movie 2. The second part stars Chris Pratt, Elizabeth Banks, Will Arnett, directed by Mike Mitchell. In the sequel, the citizens of Bricksburg are facing a huge new threat, Lego Duplo invaders from outer space, wrecking everything faster than they can rebuild.
We are from the planet Duplo, and we are here to destroy you.
Hello, visitors from another planet.
There's no need to fight anymore.
See? Friends.
Ooh.
The Lego Movie 2, the second part, Charles?
Well, the first Lego movie was fresh and funny and subversive. It was visually imaginative. It was a really exciting, fun film that we all loved. But since then, we've had Lego Ninjago and Lego Batman, and the Teen Titans movie was milking a very similar brand of comedy. And so some of the bloom has come off, and this new film is very talky. It has some very unnecessary songs that, while they may be catchy, they don't do anything to advance the story. It feels much more like a big toy commercial, and one big problem I had with it is it's predicated on what seem to be very outdated gender stereotypes. Little girls like hearts and stars and glitter and everything to be pink, and boys like explosions and superheroes and spaceships. And that seems to me a really unworthy premise for something, so to follow up to something so imaginative as the first one. There's more live action, and the basic message is go play with your sister the way she wants to play, with a lot of elements stolen from Toy Story 3. Particularly the sequence of them playing is just Andy and Bonnie, you know, just before he goes away to college. There are some other sequences that owe very heavily to the Toy Story. It just didn't do much for me.
Claudia, what did you think?
I felt similarly. It felt frenetic to me and sort of chock full of pop culture references that weren't particularly clever or funny. It was predictable. I really liked the first one. I did feel like this was kind of a giant commercial for Legos. In fact, I even felt like it might have been a commercial for Carl's Jr. and one of the stars.
Yeah.
Looked exactly like that logo. I don't know if they're like doing the, you know,
the
crossover toys and stuff. But, you know, the message was about holding on to your inner sweetness. It was a little heavy-handed, a little obvious. I did like some of the characters. One of the main female characters, who is played by Elizabeth Banks, and One of the problems I had was that they interspersed live action a little bit too much. The first one brought it in at the very end with Will Ferrell, which I thought worked really well as the father something. This one, you have Maya Rudolph as the mom and the kids. It's kind of interspersed all the way through, so it feels a little bit muddled. It doesn't have a big reveal.
A thankless role for her.
Yes.
Well, part of the problem, too, is that twist at the end of the first Lego movie is so profound.
Yes.
The fact that everything we had just seen is like the imagination of the little boy, and then when you realize, oh, this is him playing in his basement, like Will Ferrell is actually president of business, like that is it's stunning. Like I cried at the end of the first Lego movie. This already has that built in, and yeah, they do go back and forth too frequently between the animation and the live action. It kind of messes with the pacing of it. And there's some jokes that just they go to over and over again, like the banana tripping on its own peel wasn't really all that funny the first time. Charles, you didn't like the songs. I love the songs this time. They are so fun. And yeah, it is still high energy and it's zippy and you can't catch all the pop culture references the first time around. I had a really good time, but nothing could ever compare with the ingenuity and just the infectiousness of that first one.
And part of the appeal, part of what was so great about the first one, I think, is I remember us talking about it beforehand, like with low expectations, like how stupid is that? And the movie was so inventive, was so funny, and had such an edge to it. I think that's hard to get back.
Kind of what Phil Lord and Chris Miller do so well. You know, when we all saw 21 Jump Street, we thought, "What's that's going to be?" And they surprised us, and it was wonderful and inventive. And I think that now our standards are so high for Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
They also did most of the work on Spider-Man.
Yes. Into the Spider-Verse,
but I think you had a similar problem with Incredibles 2, that was the film that showed us how to animate human characters in CG without them looking like waxworks. Turn them into a cartoon, exaggerate the designs, exaggerate the movements, and they come alive. And so the second one was not the revelation the first one was. And I think what we're all saying is that that's true of this, too. The first one was so good and a revelation in its way, so imaginative in its visuals, that they can't live up to it.
We're talking about the Lego Movie 2, the second part, directed by Mike Mitchell, written by Phil Lord, Christopher Miller, Matthew Fogel, and Raphael Bob Waxberg. It's rated PG in wide release. The comedy What Men Want stars Taraji P. Henson, Adam Shankman, the director. It's a gender-flipped version of the 2000 release What Women Want, a woman in this film developing the ability to hear men's thoughts.
I feel weird after last night.
Yeah, that's what happens when tequila meets desperation.
Okay, stop doing that.
Stop doing what?
Talking without moving your mouth and saying things you shouldn't be saying to your boss.
I swear on my life I would never say anything disrespectful or inappropriate to you, ever.
Which is more than I can say for you.
Right there. You just did it. You said more than I can say for you. I heard you say it.
But I didn't say it.
Holy crap. Can you hear my inner thoughts?
I can hear your inner thoughts.
Taraji P. Henson is Mel Gibson in What Men Want. Claudia, what do you think?
Well, I liked her better than Mel Gibson, I'll say that. It's kind of muddled. I mean, it has, I won't say it's certainly not a success, but it's not a complete failure either. I think that she's energetic and sparkly, and I liked Taraji P. Henson. It's a little, the tone shifts a little bit. At first, I thought, I was really heartened because I thought, okay, here's a film that's taking on what it's like to be a woman of color in an industry that's dominated by white males. And you know, she's going up against
a
boys club.
Agent, right?
She's a sports agent. And everybody else, you know, who's a sports agent in that particular firm is a man and white. I think there might be a couple of black guys, but they don't figure into it. And in that vein, it seemed like there might be some empowerment. And there were moments of that. On the other hand, it sort of went in another direction by the end, the third act, which is like taming a career woman. All she really needs is a good man and she needs to be nicer. And so it kind of felt like it might have had some sharpness and some bite and ended up being defanged. And she's great, but I really felt like the pop culture references weren't great. The humor was spotty at best. It just didn't work ultimately, but there were some moments that I thought worked.
It's extremely hit and miss.
Yes.
Like the things that you can hear the men thinking are a lot of the times so mundane, like, did I leave the coffee pot on?
Where are my socks?
Right, and that's supposed to be funny, like, okay, not all men's thoughts are shocking or inappropriate, like sometimes they are just like the stuff of daily life, but it's so hit and miss, and she is so charismatic, and she makes terrible film choices. Why is that? Over and over again, like Proud Mary. Was it 2 Januaries ago, last January? I don't know what Taraji's thinking when she says yes to these scripts, because she's got charisma for days and she can play every kind of character. And here, I guess it seemed like a fun showcase and a big arc, because it's a very physical role. It's a very broad comedy. And she's got these wacky gaggle of friends who are essentially interchangeable. They're all sort of the same person. And then there's a whole thing with Erykah Badu as the psychic.
That was kind of funny, because she plays this like weed-obsessed psychic who's tea may or may not be the reason why she can read men's thoughts.
Right, she's like a manicurist / pot dealer / psychic. And I feel like a lot of that must have just been improvised, and then they let her go loose and then just didn't rein her in. This movie is about 2 hours long, and it just keeps not ending. Like, repeatedly think, okay, we've reached a sensible conclusion here, and then there's more, and then there's more resolution. Like, okay, we get it. So, not the best from Taraji here.
That's too bad. As you say, she's so talented and has such charisma on screen that she needs roles worthy of that talent. What Men Want is the new film in which she stars. Adam Shankman, the director, Tina Gordon Chisholm, Peter Hike, and Alex Gregory are the screenwriters. It's rated R in wide release. High Flying Bird is the new Steven Soderbergh film, starring Andre Holland and Zazie Beetz, Melvin Gregg in the cast, all filmed on an iPhone. High Flying Bird. Christy, what do you think?
This is probably the best movie of the week, I would say, and this is available on Netflix, so you can watch it right now after you listen to our broadcast, of course.
Watch it on your phone.
Yes, you could. And this is the second film that Soderbergh has made on his phone. He did Unsane a year ago with Claire Foy. And the imagination that Soderbergh brings to every project, he seems so free here with the movement that an iPhone allows him. And it looks pretty great. I mean, it looks very slick. And you never know it was shot in an iPhone unless we just told you. This is the second movie in a row about a sports agent trying to secure the number one NBA draft pick.
I saw them back to back, so wow. I was confusing plot points.
it's so good. It's slick. Terrell Alvin McCraney wrote the script. He's the Oscar winner who wrote Moonlight. And there's such a snappiness to the dialogue and a briskness to the way that Soderbergh edits these scenes. Andre Holland and Zazie Beetz together are amazing. They have tremendous chemistry as this agent and his assistant. And it feels slick and zippy and fun, but it's got so much to say about capitalism. And it's sort of an allegory about the NBA as a modern day form of slavery, with these young men just being exploited for their abilities and the fat cat owners reaping all of the rewards of it. Also, Sonia Son is great as the head of the Players Association, who is negotiating on behalf of the players during this lockout. This is dazzling.
I wouldn't think of NBA players as being a naturally sympathetic for financial reasons group.
They are. They're broke in this movie.
There are actual real NBA athletes. Reggie Jackson, Carl Anthony Towns, Donovan Mitchell. They had this little segment where they're being interviewed in a black and white. And that's a really nice counterpoint to what's going on. Andre Holland, of course, was in Moonlight, and he's fantastic. And he was also in The Nick, which is another Soderbergh project. And he's fantastic in this, as is Zazie Beetz. And it's kind of a classic Soderbergh construct, because, you know, when you think about like Aaron Brockovich and even Magic Mike, he likes telling stories of like individuals who are kind of going up against the status quo. So it's in that vein. I think the pairing of him with Terrell Alvin McCraney is inspired. It's such a beautiful, sharp, layered script. It kind of brings in almost Shakespeare and sort of moments that feel almost, you know, like a church sermon, with like, you know, very snappy dialogue. And it's delivered so well by the actors. Really great.
Bill Duke is really great also, as the basketball coach up in the Bronx.
When is like Bill Duke not
always. It's a tremendous cast.
High Flying Bird is the film from director Steven Soderbergh, Terrell Alvin McCraney the screenwriter. It's unrated. It's streaming on Netflix. You can also see it on the big screen at Limley's NoHo in North Hollywood. It's unrated. We'll also just quickly get started on Cold Pursuit, which is an action thriller starring Liam Neeson and Laura Dern. Hans Petter Moland, the director. Christy?
This is a remake of a Norwegian film, which I actually had the pleasure of talking about on Film Week when it came out.
You get to do both.
Full circle.
I have. And the same director, Moland, directs this English language version. And what happens, I feel, frequently when foreign language directors then direct an English language remake of their own work is that something gets lost in the translation. And that is what happened here. The dark humor that made that film really daring and really strange and really cool just somehow just gets lost here. And we have Liam Neeson playing yet another vengeful dad figure.
Turns out he's really like that too.
That's a whole other conversation to have. But yeah. He's a snowplow driver, and he goes on this killing spree to avenge what has happened to his son. And he goes after all these various drug gangs, going up and up the ladder until he gets to the final, you know, drug kingpin that he's after. And it's really violent and really bleak, and just feels kind of flat. We've seen Liam Neeson do this kind of role so many times and so much better, and this just feels disappointing.
The film Cold Pursuit, it's in wide release, rated R. The screenplay is written by Frank Baldwin, based on the Norwegian film In Order of Disappearance. Much more to come on Film Week. We'll hear from our critics. Also take a look at the Oscar-nominated shorts. It's Film Week on KPCC. A wonderful actor, Albert Finney, passed away this morning at the age of 82. Going all the way back to Tom Jones, in which he was the title character. But, you know, so many terrific performances over the years. You remember Scrooge? He was Ebenezer Scrooge in that film, Murder on the Orient Express. And you know, the movies went on and on up until more recent one. He was Daddy Warbucks in 1982's Annie. Man with a very, very long and distinguished career in film, and came up with other top British actors, you know, people like Alan Bates and others of that generation. We were out to dinner. We were in Hawaii. We were on Maui and out at a nice restaurant, and Finney happened to be at the next table with his manager at the time. And so we struck up a conversation. We rode back after dinner together. And, you know, I knew his reputation, being quite the ladies' man and all. He was so charming, I thought I was losing my wife. In a 20-minute car ride, I thought, Kristen, well, I'd lost her. Albert Finney has my wife.
Yeah. I mean,
exactly. I didn't know whether to feel bad about it or
just treat it up.
Yeah.
He was under the volcano. Remember how great he was.
He's such a delightful person.
That Tom Jones is still just such an iconic, the famous eating scene in that you don't forget it.
Absolutely. So our condolences to his family, but a big loss to cinema as well. Very talented actor. We continue on Film Week. Our critics this week are Claudia Puig, Christy Lemire, and Charles Solomon. Everybody Knows stars Penelope Cruz and Javier Bardem. The film, written and directed by Asghar Farhadi, the Iranian director. Claudia, what'd you think of Everybody Knows?
I love Asghar Farhadi, I should say. I really loved A Separation, which won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. I liked Salesman a lot. I liked another film that he did called The Past. I liked this one a little bit less than those others, but I still I thought the performances were great. He's just so astute with domestic dramas and the way he kind of examines small problems that kind of blow up into bigger issues. And they almost feel like psychological thrillers when they sometimes spark from, you know, just a discussion or, you know, misunderstanding or something. Here, it's almost the opposite, where he starts with a bigger issue. And I don't think it's giving anything away to say there's an abduction. I'll just say that. And then he goes to the smaller problems or the things that are bubbling under the surface. So it kind of is a different direction for him. And of course, it's the first time he's shot in Spain with all Spanish actors in Spanish. And it felt very atmospheric and evocative. You have Javier Bardem, Penelope Cruz, a very famous Argentine actor, Ricardo Darín. The acting is fantastic. And to me, that's what makes it worthwhile. It kind of drags a little, and you don't have sort of the gripping sense of suspense that you do in some of his other films. So it's not the best of Farhadi, but even a lesser Farhadi is better than most films.
And how's Madrid? I mean, is it the city?
It's just outside
well?
Of Madrid. Oh, okay. It's like a small town, a village. And it's you really get a sense of Spain. Apparently he lived there for 2 years to really get a sense of the place before he was making the film. And I loved hearing the Spanish, and I love, you know, seeing all these fantastic Spanish actors. Javier Bardem is a little bit hammy, but that's kind of his part. And it's a tale of like love and crime and family squabbles, and you really get the sense of place with it too. So I liked it.
Everybody knows. Christy, what'd you think?
Yeah, the sense of place is definitely one of the stronger elements of it. Just the observant way in which he'll notice people hanging out of their windows or like sitting at a table at a cafe and everyone's watching everybody else, and you get this insularity, the sense that it is this kind of claustrophobic small town in which everybody does know what everyone else is doing. When it is a character drama, when it is playing to Farhadi's strengths, it is great. It is gripping. And the resentments and the secrets and the regrets that are like bubbling beneath the surface until they finally explode, that's all interesting. The actual crime, the actual whodunit, feels very mundane to me by comparison and not nearly as intriguing. And I didn't know who it was. I was surprised to find out why things went down the way
but
that they did.
Very exciting.
But then I was like, oh, yeah. That's it? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But but Penelope Cruz and Javier Bardem, although they don't play a married couple here, they play a couple that has a past from their youth. And they have, of course, tremendous, crazy chemistry with each other. And it's always a joy to watch them. It's a very showy part for Penelope Cruz, a big arc she has to play.
A lot of crying.
But she shows up and she's like, she's radiant to be back home with her family in her hometown. And then like she undergoes a big, significant transformation as the film goes on. And that's exciting to watch.
And the people who play her sisters actually look like her, too.
Yeah,
I was going to say, one of the things that I think about Farhadi as a director that he does so well is he does that relational stuff where it's not explicit. It's just sort of implied.
Yes.
And he shows in the way the characters just sort of move about, even mundane things, what's beneath the surface. And that's a gift that's very hard to do on film.
Absolutely. He never bothers with exposition. You know, things are unraveled. The layers are peeled back. And you get that here, too.
Everybody knows the latest from Asghar Farhadi, the director and writer of the film. It's rated R. It's at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then the Bigfoot.
best title.
The Oscar for best title goes to stars Sam Elliott, Aidan Turner, and Ron Livingston. The film is written and directed by Robert D. Kraskowski. Christy, what'd you think of The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then the Bigfoot?
Well, if anybody can do all that, it's Sam Elliott, right? Like, nobody else can pull off all that. So this is a kind of a weird mishmash of stuff, as the title itself might suggest. There's a lot going on here. Sam Elliott plays a man who is, you know, at the end of his life, and he's got some regrets and got some remorse, and there's some introspection going on. He's living in a small town, and it flashes back to when he was younger and going off to World War II. This takes place like in like the early 80s. And so it flashes back to when he's going off to World War II and the training he receives to kill Hitler. This assumes that he's a dude who assassinated Hitler, and that's what brought World War II to an end. Hooray! And then another assignment comes his way from a very shadowy government figure played by Ron Livingston, that he's got to go kill Bigfoot now, because Bigfoot is the carrier of this major viral disease that is like wiping out entire populations. And so like if anyone's going to do it, it's going to be this guy. And it's the conflict he feels within himself. It's far more gripping as an understated character study than it is as this wild B movie. Like you see,
and it's all done straight.
Yes, it is not a comedy.
With a title like that, you really want it to be a comedy.
I mean, like,
guess in the story.
Maybe Bigfoot is a metaphor for something. I don't know. Maybe it's not really Bigfoot. It's our own internal personal Bigfoot.
Our athlete's feet.
It's a very popular one because we had Smallfoot last year.
We did.
there's a Bigfoot movie from Laika coming out this year, and there's
a
couple of others in the works. Yes. So apparently we're in a Bigfoot era.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the director is smart enough to let Sam Elliott just be Sam Elliott on screen quite frequently, and that's quite compelling.
Yeah, he's another one of those people who's always great, whatever right? he's in. The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then the Bigfoot is unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, and the Frida Cinema in Santa Ana. Untogether stars Jemima Kirk, Lola Kirk, and Jamie Dornan. The film written and directed by Emma Forrest. Claudia?
Well, this film follows several screwed up, kind of trendy, sort of aging hipster Angelinos that you really don't care about. So that's a problem to start. it's a real hearty endorsement. You have a few intriguing moments between Jamie Dornan and Jemima Kirk. Jamie Dornan is, not trying to get anybody to indulge in 50 Shades of Grey, so that's nice. It's awkwardly paced. It's kind of, the stories are one. Billy Crystal plays a rabbi, and he feels like he came in from another movie. I don't even know why he's there. Well, I do know why he's there, but it's people are looking for love, and they're looking for spiritual sustenance, and it feels forced. It feels kind of like indie cliched. It didn't work for me.
Yeah, there are some individual moments that do work. And Jemima Kirk and Lola Kirk are sisters, and so they obviously have a nice, easy way with each other. I enjoyed Jamie Dornan using his own Irish accent.
Yes, that's always nice.
That made him a lot more, why couldn't they have made Christian Grey Irish? Like, how much sexier would Christian Grey have been?
Because the Irish would have been up in arms.
Right. I guess. But you realize, when he's speaking his accent, I get it now. Oh, okay, this is why they cast him. There are some individual moments, but they're all such cliches. They're all such types. Ben Mendelsohn is in this, and we see him from behind his bare butt for the first time we see him, and he's like this aging rock star. Everyone's kind of a type.
He was married to the writer-director.
He's married to the writer-director. That's
they're divorced.
Why now, we yeah. see his naked butt in the beginning of it. But yeah, this just feels like there's like a whole subgenre of indie of like lost Angelinos trying to find each other. And
exactly.
This is one of them.
It's kind of mumblecore, but whatever, yeah.
Untogether, rated R, Arclight, Sherman Oaks, Berlin, I Love You, which is a German-Austrian-U.S. co-production, the romantic comedy starring Keira Knightley, Helen Mirren, Luke Wilson, Jim Sturgess, Mickey Rourke, many more. And it has multiple directors and multiple screenwriters. Berlin, I Love You. Claudia.
It has multiple stories and none of them are interesting. It's, Berlin deserves better. It's uneven. It's limp. It's, these anthologies, they had Paris Je T'aime, they had New York, I Love You, they had Rio. This is the fifth and none of us can remember the fourth. So we figure it was Topeka or something. But in any event, this one I don't know why they don't work. You think they might work. And I think with the first one that I remember, which was Paris Je T'aime, I think that was the first one, you had like the Coen brothers and you had some really interesting filmmakers contributing. And I think successively you have less and less interesting filmmakers. You have some great actors in this, Helen Mirren and Keira Knightley. This is probably the most interesting vignette. You have Diego Luna in a transgender role. You have, interesting possibilities and they just don't come together. It feels very forced and artificial. There's the one that's particularly awful with Mickey Rourke and this blonde that he meets at a bar and he's trying to seduce. And there's possibly she may be his daughter. And it's just icky. It just it makes you. I know. Exactly. You find yourself recoiling as you're watching it. So ich nein bin a Berliner.
Berlin, I love you. Not. Rated R at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in Hollywood. The Amityville Murders takes us back to the familiar horror story. Daniel Farrens, the writer-director, John Robinson and Chelsea Ricketts star. Christy?
This is an origin story. Every superhero gets one. Now, horror movies are getting them now, apparently, as well. These are the murders that took place in the house where Amityville Horror then ended up taking place. Of course, it's all based on a true story. We find out what it is that drove Ronald DeFeo Jr., Butch DeFeo, to kill his entire family. And it's It's atmospheric and moody here and there. Some of the editing is kind of frenetic. It is deeply steeped in like cheesy 70s polyester culture. Diane Franklin, who was like an 80s darling in movies like Better Off Dead and The Last American Virgin, now plays the mom here of this whole family. And she's really over the top. She's doing this very broad kind of New York Italian accent. And it is how this young man, played by John Robinson, slowly loses his mind and begins hearing noises, and he's paranoid. But there's some ambiguity to that because he does a lot of drugs, and his father is extraordinarily abusive of him. So there are a lot of factors at play here that might push him over the edge. Whatever the combination of stuff was, he gets a shotgun and kills everybody. The end. Oh, boy.
Anxious to go see that, too. The Amityville Murders, unrated, the horror film at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in Hollywood. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'll be back with our trio of critics right after this.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances. Now nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. Kenneth Turan of the Los Angeles Times calls it passionate, emotional, and fearless. And AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, for consideration in all categories.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Marvel Studios, presenting Black Panther. The LA Times raves Black Panther is the cinematic event of the year. Vanity Fair calls it a political and social triumph. USA Today acclaims Black Panther is a rousing cultural movement. And now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including costume and production design, score, original song All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Director Yorgos Lanthimos, Best Actress Olivia Colman, Best Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Best Original Screenplay, Best Costume Design, Best Film Editing, Best Production Design, Best Cinematography, and Best Picture of the Year. For your consideration.
One of the highlights of the years for me is being in the presence of all of our Film Week critics on stage at the Theater at Ace Hotel. I love working with them every week on the program, but there's something about the energy of getting them all together in one place, seeing the camaraderie and the gentle teasing and the fun that goes on between our critics. It's really a delight. It's so much fun for me to do the program. And if you've been in the past, I know you know what a fun afternoon it is. We have tickets left for next weekend, Sunday, February 17th, 17th Annual Film Week Academy Awards Preview. Get your tickets, kpecc.org/in-person. We show clips of all the Oscar-nominated films on the really big screen there at the Ace, and our critics talk about all the major categories. We continue with this week's films, joined by critics Christy Lemire, Charles Solomon, and Claudia Puig. The Prodigy, Taylor Schilling, Jackson Robert Scott star, Nicholas Schilling McCarthy, and Jeff Bueller, the director and writer, respectively. Claudia?
Well, we were speaking of horror tropes, and this is yet another one. It's a variation on The Bad Seed, The Omen. It's the scary little genius boy. There's the scary little girl, and this is the scary little boy. And then you add the sort of psycho killer sort of overlay of that, and their identities meld in a very sort of hocus-pocus-y kind of supernatural way. there are moments, there's, you know, sort of typical things like jump scares, and there are a couple moments in which it works. And the idea is, you know, as one is born, the other, as one dies, the other one is born. And so he, this creepy little boy grows up to do all kinds of things that should tell you. He tortures his babysitter, flies, buzz around. He sings a creepy little tune. He speaks Hungarian in his sleep. So that's always a sign. Yes. If your child does that, you know,
get
not
him
a
off
good
to the
sign.
Therapist.
Yes. Anyway, it's, you know, it's sometimes suspenseful. Build up is really most of the fun, and it's not great. It's, you know, I would say go back and watch The Omen or The Bad Seed.
The Prodigies, the film, the director, I misstated his name, Nicholas McCarthy, Jeff Buehler, the screenwriter. It's rated R in wide release. Under the Eiffel Tower, a romantic comedy starring Matt Walsh and Judy Godrej. Archie Borders is the director and co-screenwriter. Christy?
This is a white man having a midlife crisis movie, which is never terribly interesting.
You know, I remember saying on this show, I'm so over middle-aged white men and their midlife crises. And I remember Larry saying, we're not.
Well, here's another.
We never tire of that subject. Yes.
Well, yeah. So, and this one asks us to accept Matt Walsh as a romantic lead, which would be fine if he were given more to play. He's a jumble of contradictions and quirks and character traits that never quite add up. Like he's kind of selfish and kind of immature. He's
unlikable.
He is. He is a bourbon salesman, whiskey salesman.
Yes,
bourbon,
he's a
right?
bourbon salesman. And does a lot of bourbon drinking.
Right. And out of nowhere, he asks his best friend's 24-year-old daughter to marry him under the Eiffel Tower when he joins them for a trip to Paris, and that sends him reeling. But then he meets this woman who saves him, who runs this beautiful vineyard, who is Judy Godrej. Yeah, yeah, she's young and she's beautiful.
And she has a husband.
Oh, that was a spoiler.
Sorry.
Yes, Gary Cole's in
perfect.
It. Gary Cole's in it. And it just never gels, you know? It's never that funny, never
no,
that romantic.
It's very contrived.
Some of the scenery is nice.
Well, it's France.
It's
so,
France.
Yeah,
it's
why
the
not?
French countryside. It's yeah. a vineyard in the French countryside. Can't really go wrong there.
Right.
So, you know, seriously, one of the problems I have with the midlife crisis genre, so I'm not really a fan, is that it sort of excuses
bad behavior
under yeah, and I find it very difficult to relate to the men in this position because they're acting with such typical disregard for everybody around them.
That's exactly right, and this is a perfect case of that too. Okay, since I've already spoiled it, I'm so sorry, everyone.
Go ahead, just rip the band.
Millions of heartbroken listeners.
Yes, they're all coming with pitchforks. Gary Cole plays her mate, and he's in a wheelchair. And so he gets sort of cuckolded. And so what is that saying about disabled people, that they're kind of, you know, sexless? And so that's insulting on many levels. And the fact that there's this guy is willing to do that is also makes him very unlikable. And the fact that he proposed to this woman, you know, who's half his age for no real good reason. He spent $7,000 on a diamond ring, and then because he'd been fired, no one really explained. It's all very contrived and cringe inducing. And yeah.
Also, Reed Scott is the Scottish soccer player becomes his wingman, and he's even more obnoxious
they
than
render
Matt Walsh
him obnoxious.
Is.
Yeah.
But I think we're supposed to think these guys are kind of hilarious and adorable. But they're not.
Under the Eiffel Tower, Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, it's unrated. 1 Million American Dreams, a documentary directed by Brendan Byrne. Charles?
Well, this is a potentially interesting subject. In the last 150 years, 1 million impoverished and unknown people have been buried on Hart Island, in the river off New York City. But they don't tell you what would make it interesting. There are lots of cliched shots of people walking around New York. There are portentous monologues about there's economic inequality in New York. Well, boy, what a surprise. About an hour into it, they start getting into what should really be the story, which is how this one man got lost in the paperwork and ended up at a medical school and then buried there, and his family couldn't find out what happened to him. But it's too late to start that. So it's just not that interesting.
1 Million American Dreams, unrated, Lemley's Music Hall Theater.
Also a screening this week are the Oscar-nominated shorts. Every year gives moviegoers a chance to see the best animated shorts, the best documentary shorts, as well as the best dramatic shorts. And Charles, why don't you start us off with the animated films? We've got Bao, Weekends, Animal Behavior, Late Afternoon, and One Small Step. Which of the films stood out for you?
Well, all of these are good, but there's nothing like Dear Basketball was last year that stands out, that excites you about Glenn the use Keys. Of the animation and so forth. Bao, I think, is the likely winner. It's the very charming story of the Chinese mother's separation anxiety. It was screened with Incredibles 2, so it had the largest audience. It's a good film, no question. Weekends is more of a favorite with the artsier crowd. It's very stylized, very brooding about a little boy caught between his divorced parents that he has to go back and forth, back and forth. And in some ways, the backgrounds are the most interesting part of that one.
This one's hand-drawn.
Mm. Yeah.
It's beautifully, painterly.
Yeah. Animal Behavior is by Alison Snowden and David Fine, who did the one white midlife male crisis film that I love, which is Bob's Birthday, which won the Oscar and is hilarious. And this is kind of funny, but it's not on that level. Late Afternoon is an Irish film about a woman coping with Alzheimer's. That's nice. And One Small Step is about a patient, gentle Chinese father helping his daughter realize her dream to be an astronaut. And it feels like a really good student film to me. I think Bao will win, but none of these really excited me.
And Claudia, what do you think about these five nominated animated shorts?
I would say Bao is my favorite, too. I did like Late Afternoon quite a bit, this Irish film that was about a daughter and her mother who had Alzheimer's and sort of the moments of clarity that the mother has and the sweet, tender moments. I liked the painterly animation on Weekends. I was not particularly a fan of Animal Behavior. I was a little underwhelmed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what did you think, Christy?
I love Bao as well, and I sobbed
so
like a ninny. It was not pretty.
Any mom would.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Once you realize what's happening in Bao, like, oh, that's what the dumplings are. Oh, okay, I get it. But I really love Weekends. I was really taken by it, and it is so strange. Like, it's unsettling in the look of it, and you really feel this child's isolation and his confusion as he goes back and forth between both parents. And the backgrounds, as you say, are so starkly different from each other. That maybe might be a sneaky win for this. It's so good. Animal Behavior, my 9-year-old son loved, and he wants to watch it. It's a bunch of farm animals in therapy, and they're hilarious. Like it's
funny
really
premise.
It's
yeah.
very funny, and they are each who you might expect them to be. Like there's a parasite, there's a pig who keeps sneaking food. It's cute. It's very cute. Late Afternoon, you put it nicely, Charles. It's nice. One Small Step, also nice.
All right. Yeah, should mention. Oh,
I was going to say the other thing about Weekends is no dialogue.
Oh, right.
It's music and the imagery, which is powerful.
Weekends is from filmmaker Trevor Jimenez. Domi Shi is the filmmaker behind Bao. Alison Snowden, David Fine did Animal Behavior. Late Afternoon from Louise Bagnall. And One Small Step, Andrew Chesworth, Bobby Pontias, and Shafu Shang. More to come on Film Week. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Christy Lemire, Claudia Puig, and Charles Solomon. We're talking about the Oscar-nominated shorts, which are playing in selected theaters over this weekend into next week as well. We just talked about the animated shorts. Now it's the documentary shorts. And we've got five nominees once again. Black Sheep, which is a British documentary. Lifeboat, which tells about a German nonprofit and its volunteers. Period. End of Sentence, which documentary set in Delhi, India. Endgame. And A Night at the Garden, which is Madison Square Garden 1939 event. So let me start with you, Christy, on this. Which were your highlights among the docs?
I really like Black Sheep best. It couldn't be more relevant, sadly, in its story of racism and violence. It is about a young man whose family moves from London, from like a high rise in London, out to an estate more in a country type area in Essex, and it's how he's like the only black kid there in an area that's totally overrun with these racist white kids who control the place, and he increasingly discovers that if he assimilates himself with them, he will be safe, and he begins to crave their validation. It's really fascinating in the complexity of its motivations, and they have several recreations to establish moments that we don't actually have on camera, but the interviews are quite powerful with the young man who this happened to. Lifeboat's really good too. Lifeboat's also sadly very relevant as far as its tale of refugees, you know, doing what they must to survive and find a better life. Period. End of sentence actually has a Southern California tie. It was partly created with a Kickstarter from kids at Oakwood School.
Oh, wow.
Here in Los Angeles.
And is also very relevant with the news from Nepal.
It is. And it's about, yeah, women.
Lisa Tabak was the producer at Netflix.
There you go. Women who, like, start making maxi pads and, like, sharing them and selling them to teach women that there's no stigma attached to this thing that happens to all of us, which is natural, which is menstruation.
This in rural India.
Yes, and women are frightened to even say the word in the beginning of the film. Endgame is very sad. It's people at the end of their life dying from cancer, trying to find quieter, different ways to live out those last best days of their life. And A Night at the Garden is barely even a movie. I don't even know how it made it into this category. It's really interesting archival footage of a white nationalist rally that took place at Madison Square Garden in 1939, but there is no context. There is nothing. It's just 7 minutes of raw footage. I don't know how it made it into this category.
It's weird that they didn't at least bookend context for it, Charles.
It should have been the one of, if not the most interesting film, because it's this rare footage that was somehow preserved. But as Christy was saying, there's no context. It's just these clips of this rally at Madison Square Garden. I also liked Black Sheep, but as we were saying last week, I think we need another term to describe documentaries that are largely recreations, as opposed, say, to Lifeboat, which is footage on a boat that rescues immigrants who are trying to leave Libya and are just crowded like I don't know what onto these tiny craft that are beginning to sink. And this German volunteer group comes to rescue them to get them to safety. Endgame is very San Francisco. With all these,
this is the end of life.
Yeah, the touchy feely kinds of things. It's not a bad film. I suspect it will be either Black Sheep or Lifeboat because of their relevance.
All right, we're talking about the best short documentary category. Those films, again, you can see them in select theaters. And for live action, the best short films, we've got Skin, Marguerite, Madre, Fauve, and Detainment. Claudia, let me start with you. Your pick, favorite out of the live-action shorts.
I actually, strangely, I really liked Madre. It's about, you just have this woman on screen in this kind of one-sided phone conversation, and I don't want to give too much away, but it's very suspenseful. She's increasingly growing distraught and anxious, and it's kind of a tour de force in this performance, in this sort of unusual venue of somebody on the phone. I also liked Skin quite a bit. We have Danielle McDonald in that, who is in Patty Cakes and Dumplin'. And it's powerful and disturbing. It's about these skinheads that brutally beat a black man outside of a market just for being black. And then sort of you see a revenge scenario there. It feels like one of those things that's like a calling card for making a full film.
Well, he did, actually.
That's what I thought.
It played at Toronto. It's coming out later this year. It's a full-length film.
Is it also called Skin?
It is.
Yeah.
And Danielle McDonald's also in that, as well as Vera Farmiga and Jamie Bell.
Right.
Mary Stuart Masterson, Bill Camp. So, yeah, so that it is exactly.
So this is the genesis of
it. Yes, exactly.
Yes. Yeah,
which a lot of these films, I think you can say, feel like that they are calling cards.
Yes.
Resume pieces.
Particularly in this category. I think that's true.
There's one with an older woman and her caregiver that's quite touching and sort of kind of calls upon the sexuality that she once, you know, may have had or maybe didn't allow herself to have as she's in her final days. She's very ill and she has this caregiver that's taking care of her.
This is Marianne Farley's film Marguerite.
Marguerite,
right?
Yes, yeah. Which is quite touching. And then there's a couple with bad boys. So there's one with boy stealing candy and killing a baby, and another one where boys are fighting and they end up in quicksand. They're both interesting. La Fauve is the one with the quicksand. I think I prefer that one to Detainment, which is the...
Well, Detainment has been controversial because it's based on a true story about two boys who murdered a toddler. And it's been quite controversial. It felt to me like a TV episode, but they're just despicable kids, and they're treated badly by the police trying to find out what happened to this little boy they just took away from a mall.
Yeah, there have been protests as to the film's inclusion in this category
because it glorifies.
Yeah, well, they think it seems not glorify, but that it humanizes these kids.
Exploits.
In a way that a lot of folks feel like they should not be humanized. They should just be demonized and treated as monsters. The director went from just the transcripts of the kids' interrogations, and the family of the little boy who was killed was not consulted at all. And so that is what a lot of the outcry is about. It's like, how can you make this film about our baby and not even talk to us? And so they're mad about Detainment. That is also my least favorite of the five, but not because of that. I like Skin a lot. It just feels the most complete to me in terms of its storytelling, its emotions. It's sadly very relevant. Four out of the five of these, by the way, are kids in trouble movies.
Two of them are Canadian, Marguerite and Fauve. Detainment, as was mentioned, an Irish movie. Madres from Spain. And Skin is the U.S. film that's being made now, that has been made into a full feature-length movie. Again, the live-action shorts are playing in selected theaters. For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle, inviting you to join us. We'll all be there on stage at the Theater at Ace Hotel next weekend, Sunday, February 17th, 1 in the afternoon. Tickets are available. Last year it sold out. Want to make sure that you're there. Visit kpcc.org/in-person to get your tickets Sunday, February 17th, exactly 1 week before the Academy Awards are given out in Hollywood at the Dolby Theater. Back with you, of course, every Friday and Saturday. Fridays 11, Saturdays at noon for Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC.
Podcasting is supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite. Now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including director Yorgos Lanthimos, actress Olivia Colman, supporting actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, original screenplay, and best picture of the year. Now playing.